The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Hello, I'm Chris Hammonds. Welcome to the TLU podcast. We're here at Huntington Beach. We're on, you know, day two or depending on what you look at, day two or three of the Huntington Beach, of the TLU Beach Conference. It's been fantastic. We had all kinds of seminars today. The tracks were great. And now we're here. We're going to do a podcast. And the guest today is Patrick Kang. He's the founder of Ace Law Group out of Las Vegas. He's won some millions of dollars for people in Nevada, for injured folks in Nevada. And we're really happy for him to be here today. Welcome, Patrick.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure being here, especially being in Huntington Beach. It is day two for me. I don't know about other people. I've heard day three for some, but day two for me. And I can tell you that, you know, it both feels like I just got here and I've been here for a month at the same time somehow. So it's one of those amazing lecture tracks where you feel like you learn a lot. So you've been here forever. But at the same time, it feels like I just got here.
I'm sure you've experienced the same thing. But what is great about what Dan has created here is I can talk to new attorneys that have never maybe even tried the case. Yeah. And then I can turn around and talk to Joe Freed or Satch Oliver same daggum room.
Yeah.
And talk to, you know, these guys that are just incredible trial lawyers and have great ideas for every case.
Yeah.
And have you experienced that too? It's
no, absolutely. Amazing. Like even this morning, I was just walking over to the lecture hall and I walked past Michael Cohen, yeah, right? Who's like the guru for trucking. Talk to him and, you know, he gives me a nugget in just three sentences, walks away, turn around, and I see actually one of the brand new associates from my office walking out. I'm like, oh, this is perfect.
Yeah.
What a mix.
It's really amazing. I told us I was doing the tracks with Satch Oliver and Joe Freed this morning. It's just funny. So my fiance, mm-hmm, Kelly, is the smoking hot young redhead, right?
Okay.
And she's just great. And I said, and this is true. I said, she has three lawyer crushes.
Okay.
One of them, the third one is me.
Okay.
And the other two are Satch and Joe, and they're sitting right here, you know, and that's really funny. Those guys are so slick, but, you know, they're just so smooth with everything, and they're so down to earth, and they're just amazing human beings, too.
You know, the one thing I, especially like watching Joe, when I see Joe Freed, his authentic self, that's what gets me, because he's so true to himself, and he won't like pontificate. Like he gets passionate, but he doesn't get too beyond. Like he's not putting on a show.
That's right.
You know, that's the great thing about him. Yeah. You know, and I just love that. I love that about him.
He, the first time I met Joe, I sat and talked to him for like 2 hours, and it was at TLU Beach last year.
Yep.
He told me something. I was talking to him about a jail death case, and he said, you know, and I think he was quoting Shakespeare in his own way or something. And he said, you know, society's judged on how we treat the least of us.
Yeah, I like that.
And it was interesting. I just tried a case in August, and the defense lawyer got up in his closing, and he called, my clients were African-American. Mm-hmm. You know, one of them was African-American, and one of our main witnesses was African-American. They were both had legal troubles. They were in jail, right?
Yeah.
And he said, those people.
Those people.
He called them those people right in front of the jury. And it was the damnedest thing I ever seen. But I got back at my second closing, and I was like, what am I supposed to say here? And it hit me what Joe Freed said. And I literally just said it. I said, you know, last year I was talking to a great trial lawyer named Joe Freed, and he said something about how we treat the society's judging how we treat the least of us. Yeah. And I wrote that in. But it's just those little nuggets you get from these guys that stick with you and they fit somewhere.
And that's one of the things I love about TLU. And I watch on demand religiously, you know, like I don't know about you, but like I don't listen to music anymore when I work out. So I take that opportunity to watch podcasts, and I listen to podcasts. I listen to TLU on demand. And when I do that, I listen to guys like Joe Freed. I listen to guys like Satch, Rex Paris. I listen to Nick Rowley, all these guys. And everything they talk about, I can't remember the whole hour lecture, right? But there's always those little nuggets that kind of stick out and just embed itself in your brain. And then when you need it the most, like in a rebuttal closing, boom, it's there.
It's there. Yeah, I always call it just grabbing another tool, in the toolbox.
I like it.
So, you know, let's go back to in time here before Ace Law Group, and I want to ask you about Ace Law Group.
I want to ask
you about the name and talk about it. I love the name. Yeah. It fits Vegas, right?
Fits Vegas, that's right.
But tell us about, you know, I think it's really interesting that you have a real personal connection to injury cases because your father went through a horrific factory accident and you were a kid watching that and seeing that from a really interesting perspective. And how did that influence you?
I mean, that's one of the earliest memories I have is, you know, I remember of any interactions with lawyers. I mean, I was a kid, so I barely remember the nuances of it. I just remember that, you know, my dad was working at GM. He was a factory worker. An engine fell on him. And I just remember I don't know if it was months or years at this point, but there was a long period of time. He was just kind of home. Yeah. You know, like one day he was always at work. And then one day he was just home all the time. And he was in pain and things were not well. You know, things weren't good at the house. But, you know, you're a little kid. So, you know, my parents did a good job in kind of smoothing that over. But I remember the nuances of the changes in him being just home all the time and always just kind of in pain. And there's a moment that I won't ever forget, which is we're sitting at the dining room table. I'm little enough where I'm playing with like toys. I'm playing with toys at the dining room table, and there's a bunch of guys in suits there. Yeah. My dad's attorneys, and they're talking, and my parents are crying because they've settled the case with General Motors. And I don't know what it was. You know, my parents and I, we never really talked about it. And every time I bring it up, they kind of, you know, they're old school Asian parents. They kind of just kind of, they don't want to talk about it. But it was enough that we started a whole new life. My dad went on full-time disability. He used the seed money to open up his own little small shoe store in downtown Detroit. So he became his own man, his own business owner, started working there day in and day out. And before you know it, you know, I'm living in one of the nicest neighborhoods in Michigan with Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, with all the advantages that comes with. And, you know, life changed for us.
Yeah. Well, and it had to have stuck with you because now you're doing that for folks in Las Vegas and in Nevada. You're helping folks change.
You know,
as much as you can.
Because it was so long ago, when you're growing up, you know, you're living your life, right? You're going to high school. I was playing football. I went to college. You don't really think about it. Like, it wasn't my life's dream to become an attorney. But you're right, because at a certain point, when it came time to decide what do I want to do with my life, you know, I remember being a junior in college, I said, I want to go to law school. I don't know where it came from. I don't know what pushed me there. But now looking back, it had to have been that moment.
There's no doubt, man. I think that kind of stuff for a child that embedded on you then, those guys in suits in there with, you know, they were there to help.
Right.
And then your parents, you know, you probably went from watching your dad kind of be a different guy than he was to maybe getting back to who he was.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. And becoming my dad again.
Yeah. I think that's really cool. I was influenced. My father went to prison and I thought he was, you know, he was set up.
Yeah.
He was guilty.
Yeah.
But the cops cheated. And I think I know that influenced me to want to go and fight for, you know, the little guy, guys that don't have the power.
Right.
You
know, right. You know.
So yeah, I think that's a really cool story though, because it's bound to have influenced you, to do what you do. Tell us about growing up in Bloomfield and where'd you go to college and about the decision to go to law school.
Well, growing up in Michigan was interesting. Back then, I've heard things have changed now, but back then I was maybe the one Korean within a 100-mile radius of that area, right? You know, my parents, and maybe this is all part of it. I was their translator, so to speak, but almost kind of their advocate, you know? So, you know, we would get like a crazy phone bill or something. They'd be like, oh, you know, we need to dispute this. So I would get on the phone, and I'm 13 years old, and I would, you know, be interpreting and advocating.
Yeah.
You know, and it was crazy. But for me, it was just a matter of due course, and I was doing that for my parents growing up. And I think that kind of experience, being their translator, but really their advocate, like they needed a message to be sent to, whether it was the phone company, they felt like they were getting screwed on a phone bill, or whether, you know, whatever the situation might be, I would be their advocate. And that also, I think, stuck with me and helped me.
Yeah. How was it in Michigan at that time? Did y'all feel included, or was there some bias towards you guys being a Korean family?
I think I felt it as a really young kid, but by the time we moved to Bloomfield is a very small bubble of extremely, there's a strong like Jewish heritage culture out there. And I think all of that it was a very inclusive culture. Good. So I got lucky in that sense. So growing up in that kind of bubble, my wife likes to call it, is what enabled me to maybe grow and not feel so like secluded, and especially in high school.
Sure.
I felt it in college a little bit when I moved to Cleveland, Ohio. But you know, by that time I was my own man, and I was, you know, I made a lot of friends and things were different.
Yeah. And so then you go off to college at John Carroll. Yep. Is it John Carroll College or University?
John Carroll University.
University. Yeah. And what did you study and how did we get to law?
John Carroll University, I did sociology, and I minored in English, and it was really just kind of a placeholder. Yeah. I didn't really know what to do, and I eventually realized it was just a placeholder to get me to law school. Took the LSATs my junior year. You know, unfortunately, I liked to have a little too much fun in college, so my grades weren't so good, but my testing was through the roof. So my LSAT scores were great. So I was able to go to Cooley Law School, which is one of the lower tier law schools, but I was able to go on a nice scholarship. So,
hey, luckily I say, after we pass the bar, we're all called lawyers, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I knew after my first semester, I thought, man, I'm going to go in here and do like I've made all A's my whole life.
Right.
And I was like, I'm not getting C's and stuff. I was like, nope, I'm going to end up on a phone book, fighting for people, you know. So the question is how does a kid from Michigan end up building a law firm in Las Vegas?
Oh, God.
How do you get to Vegas?
Well, that goes back to my dad. So my dad, being a shoe store owner in Detroit, he would go to Las Vegas every year for the Magic Convention. So the Magic Convention, he'd go, and that's where, you know, he would talk to vendors, and he would get, you know, goods for his store. And one thing he noticed every year he would go to Vegas is there's this growing Korean population in Las Vegas. And he would go there, he'd eat great Korean food at Korean restaurants, and come home to Michigan where, you know, there's the one Korean family. And he'd say, you know, you gotta just engage your professional life here. So when I graduated law school and I was looking at different places to go, because I didn't want to stay in Michigan. That's the only thing I knew.
Yeah.
Is I was kind of done living in Michigan at that point. And I really wanted to get away from the cold in general. So I was looking at like Florida, California.
You bet.
And my dad said, why don't you check out Las Vegas? You know? So I sent out a bunch of resumes, and I got a couple hits in a couple different cities, and Las Vegas was one of them. They invited me out. I went out. I liked it. I enjoyed my time, my weekend in Vegas after my interview. I got the job, so I decided to take it. And then within a year, that law firm, it was a kind of a mid-sized law firm in Las Vegas. That law firm, they did a whole mix of work, but they also did injury. So one of the things they wanted to do is they wanted to draw some Korean clientele. And in that time, so we're talking 2007, 2008 at this point, there is a nice growing Korean population in Las Vegas, and no Korean attorneys catering to the Las Vegas community. None. So this firm decides to put my face on a Korean newspaper, a full page ad.
Yeah.
And I want to say within a month, we were inundated with clients. So I told the firm I was fluent in Korean, which I am. But the problem is I'm not as maybe fluent as I had made myself out to be. So the reading and the writing, I'm a lot slower on that end. the speaking, I'm okay, you know. So, growing up in Michigan, I didn't have a lot of opportunity to speak Korean. So if I were to put myself at a level, maybe at like an eighth grade reading, writing, speaking proficiency level for English to Korean, which is not great when you're dealing with like complicated legal issues. So I think within a few months, I had realized that my dad was absolutely right, that this place was had a large growing Korean population and was hurting for professional help.
Yeah.
And when we got there, we were inundated. You know, before you knew it, the senior partner at the firm was taking me out to lunches at the country club. We're signing up, because they did business cases too and all that. We signed up some crazy Korean casino deal that we were helping write the contracts for. Wow. Between Harrah's and, oh God, I don't even know what happened with that. It was beyond my pay grade. You know,
right.
I was a brand new attorney and I was already helping draft contracts, but we had signed on this huge client, you know, to build up this Korean casino with a relationship with Harrah's.
So you were a hot commodity at the new firm.
Yeah. It was nice.
June 2nd through 5th, 2027. Join all of us back at TLU Beach at the Paseo Hotel. We're going to have more learning and fun than ever before. We're going to have 6 lecture tracks, 8 workshop tracks. We're going to have a golf outing. We're going to have theme parties, dinner parties every night, the Satchava Wild West party, the 80s tracksuit dinner party, followed by the 80s tracksuit pool party. And finally, we're going to finish it all off with the après-ski rooftop party. So if you want new friends, you want great food, and you want great learning, and change your life, join us at TLU Beach.
How is the Korean community? I find sometimes when you get into, are they loyal to one, they come back? Or is it less? Because I've seen that when I was doing criminal defense, I had a lot of Indian and Pakistani clients, okay. And they never left me. They just come back all the time. They'd be like, Chris, I do a divorce, I do a DUI, and they'd always come back. And it was like they never would leave, and I didn't know if the Korean community was similar to that.
It's exactly the same way, and that's actually why. So when I first started my firm, I started in June of 2009. So I was still a brand new young attorney.
Yeah.
I'd only been an attorney for about 2 years.
Wow.
Then I branched off on my own, started Ace Law Group, and we were just a jack of all trades at first because I was mostly catering to the Korean community. So it was like, if I got a car crash, it would be lucky. You know, most of my cases were a Korean restaurant owner, they got hit with like a D health grade because the Southern Nevada Health District doesn't understand how kimchi works and how that ferments. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, so they were like, oh, you left this out too long. Well, this is how we've been doing it for 3,000 years. Like, I don't know how else to do it, you know? So that was a big issue. And, you know, you'd help with that. You'd help with like DUIs and, you know, contracts, lease agreements, tenant, landlord, all sorts of stuff. So, but in that sense, yes, they were very loyal. They would come back for everything.
So when you go out, you make the decision. I mean, two years in, I mean, I remember when I was 2 years, I think I was 5 years in when I started my firm, but 2 years, man. Yeah. How did you make that decision? And was it just you starting out? Tell us how the firm was when you started.
So it was me starting out by myself. And I remember like I had gone home. My parents were still living in Michigan at that time. And I was talking to my dad. And because of just the influx of clientele we were getting from the Korean community, I was seriously thinking about just going off on my own because it just seemed to make the most sense.
100%.
You know, and I kind of wanted my dad's blessing on that and my mom's blessing on that. So when we talked, they immediately were like, you should do it. We're supportive. Like, it could be a huge struggle.
Yeah.
And my dad, who'd owned his own business for like 30 years now at that point, was like, do it. Go do it. We got you, you know.
That's good to have, though, like to have a guy like, you know, that you respect and honor his opinion, and he's a hardworking dude.
Yeah.
And he's owned his own business to say, no, this is the move.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really important to have.
Yeah. And once he kind of gave me the blessing, you know, it was just go, go, go. So we started my own firm, did it, you know, on the as cost effective as I possibly could. And I was lucky enough to bring on someone who's been with me even to today, Sue Brancini, and she is fluent in Korean as well. Actually fluent in Korean. So her and I together, we were really able to build up the Korean clientele. So that's kind of how it was for, I want to say, up until like 2016. So 09 to 2016.
How did you get, how did you come up with the ace? I know it's got to be a playoff of Ace of Spades or something, but what is
it? Oh, yeah, exactly. So if you remember 09, that's kind of the recession had hit. We're kind of hitting that fevered pitch of the Great Recession by 2009. In Vegas, at least, we had all these kind of gimmicky law firms, like Half Price Lawyers and all these kind of gimmicky law firms coming out. So I wanted to have a similar type, just name, not my name, but more of a name that also would appeal to the masses, not just Koreans. Yeah. Like if I came out like Kang and Associates, like I feel like, all right, you know, like that's kind of, I'm kind of typecasted, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So naturally, so in, there's kind of two reasons I did Ace. Obviously Las Vegas, you know, playing cards, you got the ace, right? But in the Korean culture, like in like K-pop and K-dramas, they had a kind of a saying like, oh, that's the ace of the company. That's the ace of Samsung. That's the ace of that K-pop group or whatever it might be. Like even back then, they would talk about a singular person who was the driving force of that company or that K-pop group or that whatever, you know, as the ace. So it was such a popular term in Korean culture. I'm like, okay, it's going to fit both. Oh, so that's why we came up with Ace Law.
That's great, because now you're the ace of the legal community.
Yeah, it's, I tell myself that. So,
well, that's brilliant. Yeah. So, okay, so you start this firm, you're doing everything. That's kind of what sometimes we have to do. You know, I did criminal defense, built up my firm like that. How do you move into personal injury? How's that progress?
That was probably one of the scariest years of my life. So by 2015, 16, we're, you know, now the recession's kind of dying down, right? Now we're kind of, really, these injury cases, we're starting to do these injury cases and we're doing them really well. But at the same time, you know, we're doing the flat fee, we're doing the hourly for our other clients. And, you know,
paying the bills, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I don't know about you, but I really disliked having to get money from my own clients, you know, chasing down your own clients for money and arguing about, hey, you didn't pay me last month and you didn't get me this. You promised that.
That's right. It's tough.
It's hard, you know, especially when you're fighting for them over here and you're advocating for them. Now to go back and fight with them about money, it kind of crushed my soul a little bit. So when we're doing these injury contingency cases, I was like, well, this is so much better because I'm not fighting with my clients. I'm fighting with them like I should be and getting the money from the insurance companies or the corporations.
Right.
And it just felt right. It felt better. And I felt like I was much better at it.
Yeah. Better headspace. You know, you just feel like you're going in the same direction as your client. You know?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You guys are heading down the same path together, hand in hand. So that felt nice. And that's when, you know, I remember talking to one of my partners. By that time, I had a partner. His name's Kyle Tatum. And I was like, look, you know, I think we got to go off, take a big leap of faith here, cut out everything. No more $1,000 DUIs. Yeah. No more, you know, unemployment hearings. No more health district. No more contracts. No more. Let's just focus on injury and employment.
Yeah.
Because employment law allowed us to still, you know, sue employers, right?
Yep.
When we did that first year, going pure contingency was hard because there's no money coming in.
Yep.
Contingency is a waiting game. You know, and frankly, I will admit it made us make some bad decisions on some cases that I now regret looking back. Like I wish I hadn't settled certain cases. You know,
I've been there, man. if you're in this business, there's a case that looms over you or two where you went, did I settle that because it's the right reason? Or did I do it because I needed to make payroll?
I have a case that guts me to this day. It was from that time period. a nursing home case. And it was a Korean client. Guy is in a nursing home. He's got full-on dementia. He's gets up in the middle of the night somehow. The door is propped open by a lighter. He takes the lighter, opens the door, goes out into the backyard of this nursing home, sets himself on fire.
Oh, Lord.
Third-degree burns all over his body, ends up in the hospital. 9 days later, passes away. Oof. That's 9 days. We got that case somehow. We got that case. And we ended up settling that for less than $1 million,
yeah,
which is, that's not justice.
Yeah.
Looking back now,
yeah.
I mean, that was 10 plus years ago, and I can tell you that's not justice.
I love that you're telling us this, because for young lawyers that are listening, it's fear. It's we all go through it. We're unsure. Are we good enough for the case?
Right.
We need the money.
Sure.
You start justifying, well, he had dementia.
Right.
Maybe a jury wouldn't
have seen it. He was old.
He's old and all that. And it takes us a long time.
Yeah.
And it takes all the, you know, it's kind of like the 10,000 hours to go, become the expert.
No.
For you to realize finally, you go, man, that's got massive value.
No, that was a $20 million verdict. I let my own fear take over, because the facts of the case were, it was a staff member who was working overnight who wanted to go out for a smoke. So he propped open the door, which was against their procedures. They're not allowed to prop open any doors for safety reasons.
Absolutely.
So there was a written procedure against it. He violated, propped open the door, was outside smoking a damn cigarette when this guy set himself on fire. I mean, think of the optics. That's...
Oh.
Now, I get that case. I'm taking that to trial every day of the week.
Yeah. They're going to have to pay you big money not to go to trial.
I wouldn't settle. I wouldn't settle that case. Yeah. I would just take it to trial. Let's go to the mat on that.
Yeah. Well, as you get into these cases, you know, a lot of lawyers, especially Vegas, man, I mean, it was some real fertile ground out there. It seemed like y'all were knocking them dead. I mean, everybody, I hear guys, you know, Sean Claggett, a bunch of these guys
Sean
out
Claggett,
in Vegas,
yeah,
crushing it. When does it come to you that you go, man, I want to be in a courtroom? Because big difference between personal injury guys, you know them, and I'm not saying they're bad, but there's personal injury guys that don't want them. They want to run a good business, they want to get good numbers, but they don't want to be in a courtroom. When did you decide you want to be a trial lawyer?
You actually mentioned the guy who ignited my passion for that. So Sean Claggett. So back, now we're talking like circa 2016, 2017, 2018. Sean Claggett and Will Sykes, his partner, who happens to be a very good friend of mine. So Will and I have known each other for many, many years. Fantasy football league, you know, right, type deal for 20 years now. They got into the reptile game. So Papa Don Keenan's reptile.
Not to interrupt you, but I started into the reptile with Sean.
Oh,
we were both, you know, fairly young, and I can remember him. I'd go to these, you know, Atlanta, and go to these reptile summers, and there's Sean.
Yeah,
he was there all the time, and you know, we didn't know each other, but we knew each other. You know, you go to these conferences, but we've been to enough of them, and he really took off like a meteor, man.
Yeah,
I mean, just unbelievable.
Yeah, no, he gets it.
Yeah,
and he's always gotten it. So they kind of were the, you know, they were kind of blessed as the Nevada heads of state for the reptile.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and that's when I started getting involved. So I started getting involved with that and, you know, getting the books and taking the classes. And, you know, Sean would have these big lunches at his office with a bunch of us lawyers. And, you know, it just set me on fire. I mean, and you know, say what you will about Don Keenan and the reptile method now. And I know it's a little bit antiquated maybe, but that's what really, for me at least, started it. It really was the plaintiff's revolution, because that was the first time I felt like, oh, so you don't take a beggar's cup to the insurance company saying, please give us money? Yeah. You can tell them what to do?
Yeah.
No.
Right.
And that's when I was first, like, that ignited my passion.
Yeah.
So I remember the problem with the reptile was they wanted you to say the exact words that were given to you by the papa.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yes. Like, if you have to say it exactly. Like, here's your rebuttal closing, Patrick. for a missed case. And if you say these words, you will win and you will win big. And I remember going and literally like reading these words and I would get defensed.
And
I'm sitting there, it's like 2017. I'm spinning my wheels. I had three defense verdicts in a row in car crash cases.
Yeah.
You know, I think at that point, most people give up, right?
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I was like, I hate to say it. I think the words that maybe, you know, motorcycle ride in Georgia, you know, guy can say, well, don't fit a Korean, a young Korean attorney like me, you know? So
I'm telling you, that is the point that I try to make to everybody. Is I started out, I'm same way, man. Reptile got me fired up.
Yeah.
I started going to Reptile. And, you know, I love, you know, Keenan was, he was, you know, he's like all the trial lawyers. He was great, you know, he's like
awesome,
in person.
Awesome.
But I can't be Don Keenan. You can't be Nick Rally.
Right.
You can't be Sean Clay. You got to be Patrick Kane.
Exactly.
And I don't want to be, I love Nick Rally, and I'm closer to Nick's style than anything, probably.
Okay.
We have very similar backgrounds and upbringings, and I love his style.
Style,
right?
Makes sense to you.
Yeah. Makes sense. But I want to be Chris Hammonds getting the verdicts. I don't want to be Nick.
Right.
I think Nick's
great. You can't be Nick.
So it's like, that's where I think sometimes we get into these stylistic things like Reptile or TLC or whatever it is.
Sure.
Man, it's just to make you a little better. That's how I take it. I just take what I can from it and I move on and do my own thing.
And that's exactly how I felt about it. Because I was like, I love the idea. Why can't I just adapt the idea of Reptile to my own authentic self?
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of where I kind of was like, all right, I'm going to try my own thing married to the Reptile. And then I started winning.
Yeah.
February 18th through 21st, 2027. It's the Philip Miller Advanced Deposition College. Philip is gathering some of the greatest trial lawyers in the country to teach with him, small group format. It's going to be limited to 90 participants. It's going to be back at the Paseo Hotel in Huntington Beach. So if you want to ramp up your deposition skills, get registered today. TrialLawyersUniversity.com.
And then, but once you probably know, once you win that first jury, I think my first jury verdict was like $18,000. And I was like, this is $18 million.
Yeah,
I felt on top of the world. And I couldn't wait to get, I was back in a month later. And I think I just grabbed up a case, any case I could. It was a defamation case. And I won that one for like $300,000. And I'm like, it might as well have been $300 million. You know, it's like
big time.
Oh my God. I felt on top of the world. And justice. So that's 2018, 2019. And then I remember February 2020, I had my kind of like my comeback big car crash verdict. It was like a couple million dollars for a brain injury case. And I felt great. And then March happens. Boom. Yeah. World shuts down.
World shuts down.
So I was as devastated as anybody, right? Like, dude, I can't go to court anymore.
Nothing.
I can't do anything.
Yeah. Money wasn't coming in. And work seemed more than ever. You know, everybody wanted to push the cases, but no money's coming in. They're holding on to it.
Who knows what's happening? Right?
It's a rough time.
And actually, that's when Sean was like, hey, I'm doing a podcast. You're sitting at home. Come watch the podcast. Zoom in. Like, what's a podcast? So he gave me the link and I zoomed in, and it was like one of the first TLU podcasts that Ambrose was doing. Claggett was on it, and he was talking about, you know, something with David Ball. And I was like, ooh, this is awesome. And I'm listening to him, writing it down. So I started religiously watching all these podcasts, all these TLU case analysis that he was doing.
Yep.
And you know, and Sean's great about, like, you know, he take what, don't mimic me, but like, here's some good ideas. Well, you should test it. I mean, that's the first time I ever heard about this passion, Wadir, right? And I was like, that sounds amazing.
Right.
I love it. And it didn't fit my style, though. But then, you know Rex Paris? So Rex Paris does the diamonds.
Sure.
So he's like, what are the diamonds in your life? And I felt like that was very similar to the passion. So I just do the diamonds as my passion, Wadir.
That's it.
In the beginning.
You got to be comfortable with what it is. You got to be you. And I mean, I try to tell everybody that. Lawyers at my firm, sometimes they'll what do you say? And, I'm like, don't worry about me. Just be you.
Yeah.
And that's the best thing you can do. People just, they don't trust it yet, you know, until they get in there.
They want to know, like, well, you did it, so it worked. So I just want to copy that. Like, well, you can take that, but make it your own.
That's it.
You know?
Yeah, just make it your own, man.
I
think everybody just has to get comfortable with their own skin to be good at this stuff, you know?
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about, you know, I'm real curious about $15 million verdict. I think it was against Cosmopolitan, maybe?
Yep, against Cosmopolitan.
That sounds sexy, you know? I mean, the slip and fall for $15 million is impressive to begin with.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that case and how that, what was the injury and what your client, how that came to be.
So, yeah, we picked up this case. It was a slip and fall to Cosmopolitan. And, you know, when you hear about it, you think slip and fall. And she calls us. Her name's Debbie Fenn. She says, you know, she's going into like her third hamstring surgery. And I was kind of like, what?
Yeah.
Third hamstring surgery?
Yeah.
From a slip and fall? So her husband sends us the photographs. So there's a photograph. The back of her left hamstring is covered in one big giant bruise. So what had happened, and it was almost like a freak accident, you know? And I hate to put it that way because that's how they put it, right? But she goes, she slips, she falls. And the way she fell, it was a grade 3 tear of her hamstring. So if you're familiar with the grade 3 tear is a complete tear.
Complete.
It completely ripped off.
Yeah, off the bone.
Off the bone.
Yeah.
So it's basically useless at this point. And she was, we were lucky enough that she was very eloquent, very smart, successful realtor from Bakersfield, California. So we actually, you know, she was very eloquent in how she described her life before and how this affected her life after.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was, even though she was older in age, like she was in her 50s, she was an avid hiker. They were scuba divers. They traveled the world. She was an outdoors person.
Yeah, very active.
Very active. And I guess growing up, she was kind of like a semi-pro beach volleyball player in her younger days. So she was an athletic woman, you know? And one of the things that she loved in her life was being a grandmother. So she was like a brand new grandmother at the time. She had little, you know, grandbabies. And she had made this pool in her backyard, this beautiful pool, just to have the grandbabies over so she could play with them in the pool. Because she loves being physical and, you know, active.
Yeah, for sure.
And then
it's all gone.
She can't even get in the pool.
Yeah.
She can't even get in the pool. I mean, it was devastating. And she's got two daughters, adult daughters, who have kids. And they were as eloquent as mom. They came in. I mean, the jury is bawling listening to the daughters talk about this.
You tell me, but in Las Vegas, taking on a casino, basically, seems like, man, you better get ready.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's like a fist fight.
Oh, yeah.
I mean.
Well, so the video evidence in this case was top notch. You have this, there's the security manager. So it's kind of a long shot, and it's called the Chandelier Bar, level 1.5.
Yeah, I know exactly.
It's kind of like a hallway.
Yeah.
So you see there's a bunch of stuff going on, and the actual incident is our client walks around the corner, and then she just goes down. That's really all you see because the camera is kind of so far back. But when you go back and get the rest of the video footage, what you see is in the corner here, right out in the corner of the camera, is a security manager. He's got a mask on, but he's a security manager. And he's got a Michael Jackson impersonator next to him. And you see him like this on his phone with the Michael Jackson. They're showing each other stuff. And they're just BSing in the corner, clearly.
Yeah.
Like it's clear as day. And I'm not talking for like 30 seconds or 1 minute. I'm talking for like 22 minutes of video surveillance.
Yeah.
And during this 22 minutes, you see guys coming, you see guys drinking in that area. There's somebody bumps someone accidentally, drops a glass goes flying. Okay. Now, you can't see the glass flying right away. You got to like zoom in on certain parts to be able to see it. Mm-hmm. But the glass was flying. Here's the key moment. The security manager hears the pop of the glass. He, in the video, steps 3 feet out, looks over like that, turns around, shrugs his shoulders, and goes right back to chatting it up with Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
3 minutes and 36 seconds later. 3 minutes and 36 seconds later, Debbie Fenton comes through, slips on the broken glass, goes to the ground. Her husband, Steve Fenton, walks by, says, "Debbie, what's going on? You just fell. Get up. Get up." She's like, "I can't. Something's wrong." And Steve, her husband, goes, "What are you talking about? Just get up." Right. He gets down on the ground on one knee. He's frustrated. He's like, "Dude, we're at a party. We're at a convention.
It's embarrassing.
You're embarrassing me. Yeah. Get up." You know, he gets down. He feels the broken glass and ice on his knee. As he gets up, he's like, "What is all this?" And that's when he realizes she's laying on this broken glass and ice and liquid.
Wow.
And you know, what was powerful is the husband. We talked about that during his trial, how he was frustrated. Like, "Get up. Just get up." You know, and that was actually a powerful moment in closing because he was embarrassed. He felt guilty.
He felt guilty.
Yeah, he felt guilty that he yelled at his wife when she had literally just torn her hamstring apart.
Yeah.
That was the moment her life was ruined forever. Yeah. And he's standing over yelling at her like, "Get up."
Yeah.
You know, you just fell.
How did you guys, I mean, listen, all that sounds terrible, but y'all must have done some incredible work for a hamstring to be $15 million. And I mean, was it just the power of the stories that people came and said, you know, and was it just they were that good?
I mean, I think the power lies in the non-economic damages in any case.
Yeah.
Like I've never really cared what the medical bills say. Because I don't think the medical bills tell the true story of what the damages of a case are.
I agree.
You know, because I've been blessed enough to have cases like I'm here to teach toxic mold lecture tracks. Yeah. And, you know, those are not high medical bills.
Right.
You know, somebody gets, if you're familiar with tinnitus, tinnitus is a permanent ringing in your ears.
Yeah.
The suicide rates for tinnitus are high because no one wants to live with that. No one wants to live with that the rest of their lives. But the medical bills related to treatment for tinnitus is like $6,000 because there's no treatment for it.
Yeah.
You know, the best thing they can get you is a $2,000 big machine that sits there and tries to dampen the noise, and that's about it.
Wow.
Nothing else. There's no treatment. There's nothing else. So when you're dealing with that, like, that makes no sense to me that if through someone's negligence, you get this type of permanent injury that's going to last the rest of your life, that it's only worth 3 times meds, 4 times meds, even 10 times meds. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
How it should be valued is the duration, the day-to-day, you know, the degree.
Yeah.
Those are the 3 things that I look at. What's the degree of damages? What's the duration? Is it forever?
Right.
Is it 10 years?
Yeah.
And then what is the day-to-day? How has that affected the day-to-day? Like, you know, if you've ever had just like some neck pain, you know, it's not debilitating, but it might keep you from doing certain things. Maybe you don't work out as hard as you do.
Yeah.
You know? And while that's not a big deal, maybe one or two times, if that was you all the time, where you're like you don't bench anymore because you have a neck injury.
Yeah.
You know, you can only do other things. Like, I mean, frankly, if that's one of your passions, I mean, that sucks.
Yeah. Takes away a piece of who you are, you know.
And I think that is an important part. And then when you take that and you start, I call them connections. So like, that's not always just you, right? So like, if you have a neck injury, just like a herniated disc, you know, not like a surgery or anything like that. You know, I think about myself and I, you know, I sit there and I think about, well, what would it be like for me? Like if I, you know, so I can throw the football with my son, right?
Yeah.
But maybe I can't throw it like I used to. You know, maybe I can't be out there for an hour just sweating it out, just gunning it at each other. Because he tells me, he's 12 years old, but he's like, "Throw it as hard as you can, Dad."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Okay, like ready?" Yeah. And I'll gun it at him. But like, you know, some days I have neck issues. And when I can't do that, I can see it in his eyes. He's disappointed.
Right.
You know, and I feel bad. I'm losing these moments with my son.
Yep.
You know, and when you think about it that way, it really is kind of
gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I think it always, I try to tell clients all the time when we're getting ready is you know, I'll use something simple like a broken arm.
Yeah.
No one cares about a broken arm. Let's peel back the onion a little bit.
Yeah. It's,
what did that broken arm do to your life?
Yeah.
The change around you and you know, whatever it is, you know, whatever right. extensive injuries there are, it's not about the injury and that. It's what does it do to you
yeah.
as a human?
Yeah.
And man, it usually ends up isolating you from the world right. and from your family and your friends, and sleep's not there. And
yeah.
I think when you get into that, it's just like, it really does start to go, well, would you swap $15 million for it?
Right.
You know, no way.
No.
You know?
Like even now, I still keep in touch with Debbie, and you know, she would give all the money back and then some if she could just have her leg back.
Yeah.
In a heartbeat.
For sure.
In a heartbeat.
For sure.
That's kind of the sad thing about it.
It really is. Really is. I saw looking at some of your website and your results, you know, you do a wide variety of things, brain injuries, sexual assault cases, toxic mold, employment discrimination.
Yeah.
Is there a case that you've tried that really, I don't know, changed you or stuck with you?
Yes. Growing up as a young lawyer in Sin City, we started doing employment discrimination. Sexual harassment was one of those. For years, employment defense attorneys would laugh at me when I would value these cases, even in the six figures or like seven figures, forget about it. But six figures, you want a couple hundred thousand for a butt slap and maybe, you know, some comments about the cocktail server's breasts?
Right.
Come on. And they would laugh at me. Like, this is Sin City. You're never going to see that kind of money from a jury. And, you know, I that was a personal crusade that I went on for years. And January of 2024, I finally got to trial, and I finally did a jury verdict. And it was a hard one. It was a sexual harassment case. You know, it's only verbal. It was against a doctor. We go to trial, and man, there were some amazing things that came out of that trial, amazing moments. But what stuck with me and what I learned from it is when you have a sexual harassment case, very rare, especially like you have a doctor. Doctors are smart, right? They're not going to text like nudie pics
sure.
to the nurse. But what they will do is they'll have habits, right? So this doctor apparently liked watching porn, okay? So while we had all these allegations against him, one of the allegations was he would always be like, hey, come into my office and watch some porn with me, right? Well, we were lucky enough that this guy was a dirtbag, that it was kind of a known thing in this medical facility that this doctor would watch porn. So we were able to get other corroborating witnesses. So we couldn't corroborate the fact that he was saying shit to her. We couldn't corroborate the fact that he was, you know, trying to touch her or making eyes at her or, you know, being inappropriate with her in the workplace.
Right.
But what we could corroborate was that this guy liked to watch porn.
Right.
And look, in a doctor's office, that's dirts. I don't care how you look at it.
No one's gonna like that.
Right. In any office, that's
yeah.
dirts, right?
Right.
You know, so one of the moments was we get him, the doctor up there, and I'm like, you know, doctor, have you ever watched porn in your office? He goes, porn? Ask me again. And I was like, what? Ask you again. Have you ever watched porn in your office? You know what porn is, doctor? He's like, yes, never, never watch. I've never seen a porn in my life. And that's when I heard that, I was like, oh, this guy's definitely lying.
Yeah.
Right? So the next witness we brought up was our corroborating witness. She has no ties to our client. In fact, I was kind of worried she would ghost us
right.
on the subpoena. She shows up, and I go, you know, Miss Owens, you ever caught the doctor watching porn? She goes, porn? All the time. And everyone was just kind of like taken aback by how like dead set she was on it. And there was silence. So I think she felt uncomfortable. So she started rattling off porn sites that she caught him watching.
Oh,
it was amazing. She was like Pornhub, and she was like rattling them off. And I was sitting there like, oh my God. And we clipped that moment And we played it over in closing for the jury. And I just remember seeing the looks on their face and like, that was it.
Right.
So we got a $1.49 million verdict on that.
August 24th through 28th, Satch Oliver has come all the way from Arkansas to right here to Hermosa Beach to TLU Beach House. And we're gonna be teaching a 5-day Depositions Are Trial boot camp. You're gonna be working on your cases. Satch is gonna be working with you on your cases. So not only are you gonna transform your case, but at the end of the day, it becomes a case expense because your case is gonna get that much better. This program's limited to 10 participants. So if you wanna come, get registered today. We'll see you right here.
Wow. And that one really sticks out. And that one is like, that's my, you know, 15-year sexual harassment crusade culminating in that moment. You know?
Wow. Well, that's a great one right there. Cause you know, there's all kinds of verdicts that stay with you. It seems like to me, if you were going to talk to, you know, a family that's sitting, you know, they got somebody who's seriously injured and they're feeling right now powerless against the big company or the insurance company or whatever it is. Kind of like your family was at one point. Yeah. What do you want them to know right now that you know that there's help and what is that? What would you tell these folks?
What I'd want them to know and what I do tell my clients is that you know you've got not just me but a battalion of lawyers, paralegals, and legal assistants that you know our sole job is to fight for you. You know, and that's what we tell them. And even heading into trial, I tell them, like, don't worry about what I'm going to ask for. I promise you'll be happy. You know, I promise it's a big number. Right. You know, don't worry about the money. Worry about how this has affected your life. And know that we are, our blood, sweat, and tears is going into this trial for you, is going into this case. And one of the things I like to do is because you tell them this, and, you know, they might believe you, they might not. Well, we do trial prep days, and we do you know we use those giant post-its, and we put our whole trial plan on like 20 giant post-its, and you can imagine once those are all posted up on my wall in my office, it's kind of impressive.
Yeah.
So we'll bring them in after we do that, and they'll just kind of sit there and look, and you'll see them just kind of staring. They won't know what half of it means, right? But they'll see like it's. Literally 20 gigantic post-its with our trial plan posted on it. Order of proof, the facts that we're going to try to prove, key evidence, defenses that we're going to reverse upon them, you know, everything with bait stamps.
Yeah. I think that's a really good idea. I do a similar thing, maybe unconsciously, but I think it's important for clients to know how hard you're working.
Yeah.
Not like you're bragging or anything, but to know that you got their back. Right. And like, You're literally giving up time with your family. You're sitting at the office late,
right,
thinking about nothing but their case.
Right.
And I think it matters. I think it bonds you. You know, I mean, I've seen it, man. Like the trials we just did. I mean, I was close to these people,
yeah,
and they knew I was not going to quit until we got a verdict. You know, so I think that's a really good idea to show something like that. It gives them confidence and security.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's really really good idea. So just one last question, really. The legacy of your career, beyond verdicts and everything, what do you hope that your career stands for?
That's a great question. You know, at the end of the day, you know, it's you always think, like, how nice would it be to change the world, right? But, like, in a way, what I've learned is one case... that's enough. One person, one life. And, you know, when I look back, even now, like if my knock on wood career was to end today and I was to call it in, I'm like, you know what, I'm done, I'm retiring. You know, looking back, all the people that I've helped and that I've, you know, that we've just fought for and genuinely poured our heart out for,
right,
you know, that to me is something that makes me feel like I've been very successful. Not the money,
right.
You know. I don't even know that my verdicts are that big compared to some folks, you know. Right. But the fact that we went the distance, we stood in front of a corporation in front of a jury in a courtroom, we with our clients spoke truth to power. You know, David D. Roberta says that, and I love it. It takes a lot of courage to speak truth to power, just to do that. And the fact that we did that, looking back, I hope to continue to do it for many, many years to come. And if that's what I get to do the rest of my career, and my career ends one day, and I've done that, and I've done it consistently, and I've not been, I'll always be afraid, right? But I didn't let that fear stop me from doing it.
That's right.
Then that's job well done.
That's it. Well, I've just met you. I've read some of your stories. I think that if you're in Las Vegas and you get injured, you should call the Ace of Legal right here.
Thank you, Chris.
Very good.
Appreciate you.
I appreciate what you're saying. I think that that is fantastic way to look at it. And I know how trial lawyers, that we lose a little piece of our soul with these trials.
Yeah.
But man, what a worthwhile thing, right? I can't imagine myself doing anything else, right?
Can't imagine it. It's the opposite of how the world portrays us, really. It really is.
100%. Trial lawyers, I'll say this to everybody out there, trial lawyers are what stands between us, and that's what makes America great. And it's what stands between us and just everything. I mean, without trial lawyers, this country would fall apart.
Right.
No one to stand up against the tyranny and the power. And it's now more than ever, quite frankly.
Right.
Without good lawyers that are willing to be brave and stand up to whatever it is, big money, big corporation, greed, whatever you want to call it. I call it evil. Then we would be ruined. So
exactly.
TLU podcast, come watch it. Sign up next year, June 2nd to June 5th of 2027 is TLU Beach in Huntington Beach. You ought to sign up today. You can get a QR code at some point in time to on the website to get a free TLU on demand for 3 months. We appreciate it. Patrick, it was wonderful today.
Thank you.
And appreciate you. And we'll see you next time.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I had a great time.
Yeah.